Welcome to the second lecture in our series commemorating the 40th anniversary of Thurgood Marshall's appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. And for anybody who missed the first lecture, it's podcasted on the law school's webpage. The series, we hope, will spark more in-depth discussion on Marshall's contribution to American law, and also more in-depth discussion of the cases he tried as a lawyer. Today we deal with his most famous case in the latter category. After Thurgood Marshall successfully argued Brown v. the Board, with the Supreme Court striking down segregation in public schools, he became the most famous lawyer in America. Our guest today, Dr. Kevin McMahon, lectures on how President F.D. Roosevelt helped develop the groundwork for this victory. Dr. McMahon is currently Associate Professor of Political Science at Trinity College, and also the author of Reconsidering Roosevelt on Race. His book, in fact, was published by the University of Chicago Press, and Professor Sunstein reviewed it for The New Yorker on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the Brown decision. He flew in from Connecticut to be here today, and we're very grateful to have him. Professor McMahon.
Thank you. My talk today is really centered around the book itself. So there are some ties to Marshall, but mostly predates Marshall's appointment itself. And there's the title of the book. If John Trinetsky was here, he'd want me to have, who's the editor, political science editor at the University of Chicago Press, would want me to have the cover, but I chose not to do that. I just wanted to start with sort of the question I was asking when I began the project. This is sort of a quick chart that shows the civil rights decisions at the Supreme Court pro and against civil rights. Oh, that's a mistake. That should say anti-civil rights. And you can see where the activity is. And you can see, for much of the early 20th century, there was not much activity with regard to civil rights. Many of the cases that were so-called pro-civil rights were fairly easy cases, if you will. One dealing with the grandfather clause. In the 1930s, you begin to see more activity, and significantly, you begin to see more decisions in favor of advancing civil rights. And many of these decisions are unanimous decisions. So the question is fairly simple. Why? Why do things turn in the 1930s when they hadn't before? What's significant about this time period? And why are these decisions, for the most part, unanimous decisions? And as you might expect, many scholars have examined the origins of the Brown decision. We have a variety of explanations, what I call conventional explanations, of why Brown occurred and why it occurred in 1954. Why not 1934 or later? And these are sort of just quick... I won't talk about all of them, but a current of history discussion sort of focused on the importance of World War II, for example, the importance of the Cold War, the political pressures, particularly on the United States, that it had to deal with the issue of segregation. If it was going to be the leader in the world, if it was going to live up to the ideals of democracy, it could no longer treat African Americans as second-class citizens. And there's great power to these arguments. I don't necessarily disagree. That my argument is more that these pressures allow for a set of ideas that are already in place to be elaborated on, to be extended. Advocacy and support structure model focuses on the role of the NAACP. Certainly, Thurgood Marshall is essential to this discussion. That the NAACP, through both organization and advocacy, was able to convince the court through a number of years, or over a number of years, to finally confront the Plessy Doctrine. Political systems model comes out of political science. If you're familiar with the work of Robert Dahl from undergraduate, that sort of deals with the importance of the court following the election returns and being consistent, the Warren Court being consistent with sort of the New Deal political order. Judicial independence, the sort of the role of the court as sitting to protect the rights of minorities, either from a court-based argument or from, again, political science and attitudinal model. Judicial leadership focuses particularly on the role of Chief Justice Warren, that he was sort of instrumental in convincing this really divided court to finally unify on the issue of segregation. And certainly Justice Frankfurter gives some credibility to this argument. As the story goes, some of you may have heard this story, but as the story goes, Chief Justice Frankfurter was on his way from, Justice Frankfurter was on his way to Cambridge, to Washington by train. He was met at Union Station by one of his clerks. And when he got off the train, his clerk ran up to him and he said, "Justice Frankfurter, there's news about the court. Chief Justice Vinson has died." And Frankfurter has said, apparently said, "This is the first indication I've ever had that there is a God. Chief Justice Vinson is dead." So gives some credibility to the importance that leadership plays a role in the work of the court. Now, I don't necessarily dispute the importance of any of these arguments. What I simply argue, or mainly argue, is that what's missing here is the importance of the presidency. And I develop what's called a presidency-focused approach to understanding the origins of Supreme Court decisions. Specifically, I argue that presidents, especially reconstructive presidents, like FDR, are powerful agents of constitutional change. Under their influence, Supreme Courts are predisposed to follow the command of the executive branch. The civil rights decisions, therefore, are the byproducts of an institutional mission on the court, shaped in large part by the Roosevelt administration's policy towards the judiciary, a policy that was itself the consequence of FDR's management of divisions within the Democratic Party and his construction of the modern presidency. Put another way, FDR's conclusion that Southern democracy, in quotes, was incompatible with his institutional design served as a mainspring for the Supreme Court's later commitment to federal civil rights protection. And that this and this understanding of the importance of the presidency in shaping judicial interpretation leads us to reconsider, or should lead us to reconsider, Roosevelt's record on race. What is Roosevelt's record on race? Well, traditionally he's given scant praise for doing anything with regard to civil rights. Scholars usually look at the work of Eleanor Roosevelt, who was certainly quite active in the cause of social justice, quite visible in that activism. But when it comes to her husband, not much is done. That it was really a failure of will rather than of opportunity to improve the plight of African Americans during his presidency. And certainly, in the case of legislation, some 150 civil rights bills are introduced during Roosevelt's presidency. None of them are passed. The most important of those bills and the most visible is anti-lynching legislation, which passes by significant margins in the House year after year, but is always killed by filibuster in the U.S. Senate, controlled in large part by Southerners because of their seniority. And FDR never comes out and publicly supports the anti-lynching legislation, And people say this is the reason why it fails, that if he came out and supported it, it would have passed. In addition to that, you have key pieces of the New Deal, the Wagner Act, the Social Security Act. They're crafted in a way to exclude most African Americans living in the South. So legislatively, it's certainly true that not much is done. Specifically, I mean, certainly in terms of economic programs, improved the plight of African Americans, but specifically legislation designed to advance civil rights, not much is done. My argument is that these scholars don't look at the judicial side of things. And when you look at the judicial side of things, you get a much different story. And what I'm really arguing is that Roosevelt's pursuing a politics by other means, not focusing on legislation, because he feels that if he pushes something like anti-lynching, the Southerners that are so instrumental in advancing his legislation through his economic legislation through Congress will simply no longer, will refuse to participate, will refuse to be allies. And today I'll focus on three components of the argument. First is core packing, introduced, as you all I'm sure know, in 1937, right after the 1936 election. Roosevelt wins this massive landslide, wins every state except for Maine and Vermont, over 60% of the vote. And he's confronted with a court which he thinks will soon strike down what's known as the Second New Deal, most importantly, the Wagner Act and the Social Security Act. And this plan will allow him to increase the size of the court from 9 to 15. Just add 6 new of his justices would certainly change things. What I do in one of the chapters is to sort of get an understanding of the court packing plan, which I think too many scholars in the past have focused on it as a proposal to constitutionalize the New Deal. I think it's better understood as a way to transform the judiciary into an agent of the modern present, into an ally of the modern present. And if you look at the opponents of the plan goes down to defeat in the summer of 1937. The three main opponents are, not surprisingly, conservative Republicans, first of all. Second, what are called new freedom progressives, people who are progressive but are concerned about the expanding power of government in Washington. And finally, Southerners, Southern Democrats. For example, Carter Glass, who was a senator from Georgia, said, in defending the Court of Nine, it was the Supreme Court that saved the South from anarchy and ruin during Reconstruction. That Roosevelt is with the 6 additional liberal justices that Roosevelt puts on the court, we must be very concerned as Southerners of what path this will take with regard to Southern white supremacy. If you contrast that with the views of the African American community, you get a much different story. Many African American newspapers are quite supportive of the court packing plan. Perhaps they are in part because on the same day the court packing plan is announced, William Hastie is nominated by FDR to become the first black federal judge in U.S. history. Now, he's appointed to the district court in the U.S. Virgin Islands, not necessarily a springboard to the Supreme Court, so it is a very symbolic appointment. There's no doubt about that. However, Hastie is later considered for the court. He loses out to Justice White when John F. Kennedy appoints Byron White, and he loses out to Thurgood Marshall when Johnson appoints Marshall. He's in the second case, he's considered too conservative to be appointed. Marshall is sort of the only one that Johnson is really focusing on. Of course, not all Southerners are opposed. And there's an interesting link to the core packing plan and Lyndon Johnson. In 1937, the core packing plan is introduced in February 5th. In April of 1937, 2 months later, there's a special election in Texas to replace a congressman who had recently passed away. There are 8 candidates in that race. Most of them are opposed to the core packing plan. It becomes a major issue in the race. One candidate who's not very well known comes out as the pro-core packing plan candidate. And his name is Lyndon Johnson. He's 28 years old. And Roosevelt sees this as very significant, that there's one time the core packing plan is, in a sense, tested in the elections, and Johnson, this 28-year-old congressional aide, wins the election. So Roosevelt is very, you know, sees that as significant and pushes on. When the core packing plan fails, most people say it sort of goes away. It's sort of, you know, a great error by Roosevelt. He wastes all this political capital and gets nothing for it. I argue that that's actually incorrect, that it has lasting significance for constitutional law, because Roosevelt sees it as sort of a bloody shirt of sorts. That if you were opposed to the core packing plan, you're not on board with the future construction of the Roosevelt Court. And in picking appointees, he looks at that very carefully. So he does eventually get to pack the court. He appoints 9 individuals to the court, if you include his elevation of Justice Stone from associate to chief. You can imagine today it would be quite difficult to fill a court. 9 appointees, given the time that it takes today. The 2 key things that he's focusing on, at least from the standpoint that it, to the extent that it's significant for this discussion, are 1, that they are deferential to the executive. They're willing to defer, most importantly, to the democratically elected branches. First, to the Congress, but the Congress is also in the mood to defer to the executive at the time. And 2, they're committed to what I call right-centered liberalism. And that deference, by the way, is linked to, most of them are proponents of legal realism, and there's a connection to that. Does he appoint individuals specifically to advance civil rights? No, there's no evidence of that. But my argument isn't that I found some new evidence that that's true, but rather the philosophy, the combination of these 2 principles leads to decisions like Brown versus Board. So those are the 9. Get out of the way. Many of them, very short period of time. He appoints these 3 men on the same day, Burns, Stone, and Jackson, June of 1941. His first is Hugo Black. Hugo Black is designed to upset Southern Democrats who defeated the core packing plan. Black is a member of, is found out to be a member of the KKK, which doesn't seem to fit my argument. At least I'm honest about it. However, there's actually more to the story of that. You know, the basic conclusion about why does Black join the KKK is that if you were ambitious person who wanted to be elected to the U.S. Senate from Alabama in the 1920s, you had to join the KKK. And significantly, while the NAACP reverses its position on Black, the leader of the NAACP, Walter White, does not. He continues to support Hugo Black, When the Scandal Breaks. And it's important that the scandal breaks after he's already been confirmed. The other exception is Jimmy Burns, who's appointed. He's a senator of from South Carolina. By the way, I brought the pictures just to give you some. Many of these are considered leading liberals of the day. Douglas, certainly Frank Murphy. Another interesting thing about these men is many of them were serving in administration, much different than today. Reed is the Solicitor General. Black is a sitting senator from Alabama. Frankfurter was not appointed, but very much involved in the politics of the New Deal. Douglas is the head of the SEC at the time. Murphy is the former governor, former mayor of Detroit, former governor of Michigan. Burns is a senator from South Carolina, also later becomes, he only serves in the court for 1 year, leaves after the war begins, returns and becomes the governor of South Carolina, and is the governor of South Carolina when the Brown decision is decided. Stone, currently on the court, elevated. Jackson, very much involved in the New Deal. Attorney General at the time. And Wiley Rutledge is sort of the exception to that. I think the appointment of Burns is interesting because there's a vacancy created in early 1941 by the retirement of Justice McReynolds, who's known for his anti-Semitism and his increasing number of dissents. He's from Tennessee Democrat. The Southerners go directly to Roosevelt and they say, this is the time for our appointment. It's time, you have to appoint Burns. Carter Glass, who I talked about earlier, is one of those. Now, Roosevelt has to play this in a strategic way, because Southerners are now more important to him because they're more sympathetic to his foreign policy, his internationalist foreign policy. So he needs to give them something, and they certainly want this. At the same time, if he appoints Burns, he's going to upset liberals. You also have the announcement of the planned march by A. Philip Randolph, the March on Washington to protest discrimination in industry in terms of the military production. So what does Roosevelt do? He waits. He waits for 5 months. He waits to the announcement that Chief Justice Hughes will retire. And then 10 days later, he elevates Stone to chief, a Republican, liberal Republican, known for his dissents in the New Deal cases. Appoints Burns to fill the McReynolds seat, and Burns is certainly going to be more liberal than McReynolds. And he satisfies the liberals with the appointment of Jackson in Stone's place. So it's really a masterstroke on his part. Burns had also been passed over for a previous justiceship and for vice president in 1940. I write that it must have seemed that he was Charlie Brown to FDR's Lucy. So he had to get his time. But the story is much more than just appointing 9 individuals to the court, 8 of whom are clearly sympathetic. And this is where the deference to the executive branch is essential to the argument. The Justice Department's efforts, mainly through the creation of this new section, the Civil Rights Section, first called the Civil Liberties Unit, it was changed soon thereafter, formed by order of the President by Attorney General Frank Murphy, who becomes Justice Murphy. And the effort is really to revive dead letter Reconstruction statutes that the courts had really destroyed, or virtually destroyed, soon after they were enacted. And it's a parallel, this is a criminal law campaign, this is parallel to the NAACP's focus on civil cases. four pillars of white supremacy are the target of the CRS, the Civil Rights Act. The white primary, the important case here is the classic decision, which is important precedent for Smith versus Albright. Smith versus Albright is 1944, which is an NAACP case. And the Justice Department doesn't join formally as a friend of the court, but it does work with the NAACP in the Smith case. In the poll tax is another device that's used to prevent African Americans from voting, and also poor whites. You have to pay to vote. You know, if you're poor, you're not going to pay a dollar to vote, for example. Here we have FDR's hand is clear. He writes to his Attorney General, Attorney General Biddle, and he says, as the guardian of the Constitution, you should bring a test case on the poll tax into court because of the unreasonable restrictions imposed by states on universal suffrage. And the reason why he's doing this, the argument goes, is that FDR always thought that the Congresses that were produced by the southern states were much more conservative than they should be. Why? Because not enough people voted. The people that were FDR were sympathetic to FDR's position simply were unable to vote. If they were white, because of the poll tax, if they were black for a number of, not only the poll tax, other reasons, the white primary, and other reasons as well. If you could expand the pool of voters, you could get much more progressive representatives from the South in Washington. So it's this desire, as we also see in the Purge campaign of 1938, to transform the South, to bring liberalism to the South. In lynching, the Justice Department thinks that using these old statutes, it could prosecute 60% and possibly all lynchings without new legislation. Again, the politics by other means. The one case they bring is a lynching in Mississippi. And I just want to read from the closing arguments of the case. And this is one of the congressman from Mississippi denounces the prosecution as Gestapo tactics. This is 1942. Two candidates for governor also denounce it. And you see sort of the concern that state representatives in Mississippi are having about their Democratic Party. This is the Democratic Party of the South, right? Or that was once dominant in the South, and still at this time. We may as well face the truth. This trial is not a trial to vindicate the lynching of Howard Wash, nor is it a trial only to convict three defendants. It is just another effort on the part of the crack-brained interest within the political party of our forefathers to see how much further we of the South will permit the invasion of states' rights as guaranteed by the Fourth Amendment of the Federal Constitution. An interesting choice of amendments, but the cause of white supremacy has been indicted. The people of this great Southland are on trial. We were taught by our fathers that we must ever remain Democrats, for only by our continued association with that party could we hope to maintain our cherished heritage of white supremacy and the perpetual preservation of states' rights. But now we are in a quandary to know whether we are justified in continuing that attitude of unquestioned loyalty. In the case of closely related is police brutality cases. And you see the nature of the cases that were brought during this period of time, 1939 to 1945. Mostly in the South, mostly dealing with race-based cases. The victims are either one victim and the victim's black, or a number of victims and both black and white. There's no expectation to get much punishment. Even a conviction is really a pretty surprising thing, given the case, given the fact that most of the juries are all white juries. In fact, in the Wash case, the one I just read from, which is a lynching case, when the jury comes back into the courtroom, they wink at the defense table, and they don't convict the defendants. But nevertheless, it's seen as very symbolic. Sort of the Justice Department is sending a message that the sort of old Southern, the old attitude towards the South, the federal attitude towards the South, has to change. That the federal government is now going to do something. Where they had long not done anything, they are now going to do something when a lynching is ignored. And most states would not, you know, they would just ignore it. They would not prosecute it. Also cooperation with the NAACP, and I would argue these cases are definitely impacted by the war. And I'm just going to, for more examples, this is somewhat connected. This is propaganda poster from World War II. And you see within the Justice Department, there's a real effort to define patriotism as tolerance. That you're in a war against a Nazi regime, and you're stressing democracy and tolerance, the four freedoms later on during the war. You see, obviously, the enemy, but you also see in his eye a lynching or a hanging. Now, is it connected? Do I know if it's clearly, you know, the artist intended this? No, but it is it has powerful symbolism. Another poster, "United We Win," much different than we get in other conflicts in the United States history. So what's the result? And then I'll end with some questions. The result is a Supreme Court that is constructed to be instructed by the Justice Department on race. Significantly, both the Truman and Eisenhower Justice Department carry on the tradition of the Roosevelt Justice Department. Ultimately, in their Brown briefs, that the time had come to reconsider the constitutional legitimacy of separate but equal, announced in Plessy. And in 1954, just 9 years after FDR's death, and with five Roosevelt justices joining the unanimous opinion, the court strikes down the separate but equal doctrine in Brown. So let me end there, and if there's questions, I'll respond. I'll try to answer some questions. Thanks.
Any questions for Professor McMahon? Well, Professor McMahon, thanks for coming by.
I'm trying to figure out where I'm having a hard time with the argument.
Sure.
So bear with me, I may not get out of question.
Okay.
As I understood both the history and your talk, what Roosevelt is, of course, most concerned with is, of course, implementing New Deal economic policy.
Correct.
So what he's looking for are justices who are going to defer to the executive and, of course, to the Congress. The Congress is passing it.
Sure.
Right? And, of course, that's what he gets is, well, the court's reaction is, did you say Commerce Clause? That's okay with us.
Right.
Now, at the same time, if I'm following your story, he's creating a civil rights unit that's moving along. So is it not, in one part, the civil rights unit that becomes key, since the appointments are really aimed at economic policy, and then that brings in all the other factors? We've got to get African Americans not protesting. They're so crucial to the war. Right. So isn't your story really about the civil rights division and domestic pressures and less about the court? Is that a sensible question?
Sure. I mean, I would say certainly the activity is, and just let me jump one slide I didn't discuss because I didn't think I'd have time, is the reasons why he would do this. The civil rights section is very instrumental. There's no doubt about that. And certainly some of the argument in the book that is that it isn't necessarily the president himself, it's the Justice Department itself. However, we do have clear evidence that Roosevelt is very concerned about this. We have notes. You know, he writes to Robert Jackson, to Francis Biddle, the Attorney General, on the Smith versus Albright case. Biddle decides not to join the Smith case, the Albright case. FDR writes and asks why. The classic case from earlier, Attorney General Jackson isn't pushing it. FDR writes, send some men, right, that he wants an investigation of this case. So there, while Roosevelt is not always there, there is evidence that he's pushing this unit to be aggressive.
Okay, it seems to me, though, there are two ways of responding, and maybe it doesn't matter for your argument. One is to say yes because he's committed to civil rights.
Right.
The second is yes because he wants more votes, and he assumes that the more African-Americans are able to vote, the freer they are, the more voters they get. So this
right.
is just a very partisan move.
Right.
That's the point. And the other piece of evidence I was going to ask you to respond to is Mike Klarman's argument
mm-hmm.
that the court found Brown extraordinarily difficult.
Right.
In part because they all had a New Deal focus, which meant deference, deference, deference.
Right.
And here they were being asked not to defer.
Right.
So does that complicate? Now, they come out
sure.
the right way in
right.
the end.
Right.
Does that complicate your story at all?
Yeah, let me take the first one. In terms of the votes, purely partisan play. I definitely agree it's a central start part of the story. Part of the reason is he wants the black vote. And in 1932, when Roosevelt is elected, African Americans as the support the party of Lincoln. About approximately 25% vote for the Democrats, the rest, 75%, vote for Hoover. This is in, you know, the midst of the Depression. In 1936, that vote is switched. 75% vote in for the Democrat, for Roosevelt. And this is very significant to some very big, electoral-rich, vote-rich states like New York and Pennsylvania. If that vote switches back, FDR can lose. And perhaps more significantly, is FDR wants to liberalize the Democratic Party. And while he's got huge majorities, close to 80% majorities in the House and the Senate after 1936 election, many of those are Southern Democrats who detest the New Deal. So it's not that he can simply count on his party. In terms of Klarman's argument, I think that the essential thing that's going on with the Justice Department and the court is that once the court takes the case, it's really hard, I would argue, for them to vote the other way. And so the key thing may be having them take the case. And this, I would suggest, begins in 1944 with Smith versus Albright. And then you have this string of cases dealing with some with segregation in higher education. Ultimately, Brown is the case. And Brown is important not because of education. I mean, obviously it is. But the key thing is that Brown is testing the Southern white supremacy. If you overturn segregated education in schools, that just throws everything out. So they do struggle with it. But I think it's significant that the Justice Department, both the Truman Justice Department in sort of a weak way, but still, and then the Eisenhower Justice Department, And one of the significant things I would say about Warren is he's a Republican. You know, so you have a bipartisan court and two Justice Departments, one Republican, one Democrat, saying the time has come to deal with this issue.
I'm a little confused about your argument about how the war impacts Roosevelt's civil rights record, because to me it seems the time is a little off. A lot of your figures and examples come from pre-1940, and yet the war hasn't started yet. I mean, you can make the case with Lend-Lease and some of Roosevelt's fireside chats, but I don't think he's really articulated a vision of how the war impacts his vision of American democracy. And that's complicated by the fact that a lot of the kind of motivated civil rights thoughts and arguments after the war are kind of like an if-then statement. You know, if we fight this war against the Nazis, then we need to do better at home. And you see that there's actually a kind of chronological element to that. Truman desegregates, you know, the military
right.
by executive order after the war.
Right.
So, you know, you're borrowing Truman and Eisenhower's administrative records, but that seems more like, you know, we fought this war, now let's make good on this promise. And yet the arguments about how the war impacted it come from before the war, before America gets involved.
Well, see, I mean, I think the war is important, but I guess I don't see the inconsistency with what's happening. The effort begins in 1939, if you want to take the beginning of the creation of this unit, February of 1939, before the war, right? And then what the war allows is a more aggressive effort. You know, you have Justice Department officials going into small southern counties and arguing before, this has never been done, you know, since Reconstruction, before an all-white jury, that their sheriff should be convicted of a federal crime and getting some convictions, right? I don't think you could have done that if it had not been for the culture of the war. So I think the thought process is there before it, the war allows it, and then after the war, you know, you have both the end of the war, returning African-American soldiers, and, as Mary Dudziak elaborates on, the importance of the Cold War. So, you know, I think it is a strength, and it begins, but significantly it begins in the 30s. Not in the 40s. So Truman and Eisenhower are continuations rather than beginnings.
Maybe I'd like your thoughts on that.
Sure.
If we see how the president affects civil rights policies this way, does that propagate through like future presidencies or presidencies
right.
through, you know, Carter, Reagan? I don't know if you saw any trends.
Yeah. You know, my current project is with Nixon, so for the next hour, out now. So, you know, I sort of developed this presidency-focused approach, and, you know, you might ask, well, what about, at least from a conservative point of view, people would say, you have this string of appointments, right? A brief answer. Beginning with Nixon, right? All these appointments by Republican presidents, conservatives, Nixon 4, Ford appoints 1, you know, Reagan, Bush 2. And you have these decisions, you know, Roe versus Wade, school prayer cases are not decided in a favorable way from a conservative standpoint. You know, what's going on there? Isn't this a failure of from conservative presidents to change the court? And I think, in part, the answer is yes. I don't think you can just sort of say when presidents appoint individuals to the court, everything will change. But at times, you do see success. And in some of those examples that I gave, the failures are arguably helpful to the Republican Party. Not to be too cryptic there, I want, you know, people argue that if you overturn Roe, that's going to be very problematic for the Republican coalition to stay together. Now, are the justices back there saying, well, we can't, you know, let's look at the polls and, you know, no, I don't think so. But what's the difference if you look at Roe and you look at Brown? In Brown, you have a constant sort of banging of the table. We have to deal with this. Again, sometimes more aggressively than others, but consistently. In Roe, it's the opposite. Reagan is very aggressive on Roe. George H.W. Bush pulls back a bit. George W. Bush, let me ask you this question. How many times do you think George W. Bush has used the word Roe in his 6 years in office? Zero, right? Never used the word Roe. Now, he's obviously trying to avoid, he's only called himself a pro-life president once, and that was in defense of Trump when he was trying to save Harriet Miner's nomination. He's definitely pulling back on this. Much different than Reagan in terms of his vocal support. And when you have that, the court's not going to feel the need, I would argue, to take this dramatic position.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit, you mentioned a bit about the end of the voice that you would draw to support people back after the scandal came out. What role did interest groups like the NAACP play in shaping Roosevelt's appointments to the court?
That's a good question. So if you didn't hear, what role did interest groups like the NAACP play in Roosevelt's selection of nominees for the court? It's not clear that they played much of a role. The best example, I think, is in the Burns case that I talked about, where you have memos from Walter White, who's at the NAACP, to Roosevelt saying, you cannot appoint this guy. You know, don't appoint Burns. That's the clearest evidence, at least from the NAACP, that played a role. Behind the scenes, however, there's definitely a feeling that, you know, he was listening to people. But there's no, you know, memos coming. Well, there are memos that come in, but whether or not he pays attention to them, it's not clear. Not at all. However, you have people like Frank Ferger is on the board of the NAACP. Frank Murphy is on a local chapter of the NAACP when he's in Michigan. So there's clear evidence that they're sympathetic to their arguments.
We've got a question for about time for one.
Sure.
I was just curious, you mentioned that the fact that the conservative nominated justices didn't overturn or rule in ways that we thought they might,
right,
based on who nominated them,
right,
is sort of a failure of those presidents,
right,
to get the right people to do what they wanted to do on the bench.
Right.
But can it conversely be seen as a success of the court in staying apolitical and doing its job as that unit which does not, you know, sway according to,
right,
the politics of the time, but rather rules,
right,
on the law?
Yeah, certainly if you read O'Connor's opinion in Casey, that's, you know, that's what she's basically saying, but at least in part. I guess when I say failure, I'm saying from the point of view of the president, of the appointing president. So, you know, it may be a success in other ways.
All right. Once again, everybody.